Since her marriage in 1925, Mrs. Theodore Adams has expressed her special interest in young people, young couples, and young wives in many ways. When she was a pastor's wife, her advice and counsel was often sought by those who needed help in solving family problems. During the 10 years Dr. Adams taught here at Southeastern, Mrs. Adams continued her special ministry by helping the student wives, for Mrs. Adams felt that the seminary years are a time of preparation and personal growth for the student wife as well as the student. During her years here in Wake Forest, Esther Adams worked with the Baptist Young Women and Student Wives groups in order to help in this growth. Thus, it is a very appropriate extension of the ministry of Esther Adams that family and friends have established the Esther Adams Endowment Fund for Seminary Women. The income from this endowment will be used to schedule special conferences and lectures each year, with a focus on the growth of Southeastern student wives and student women. This week, we are enjoying the second annual Esther Adams series. We are fortunate again this year to have a couple who are personal friends of Dr. and Mrs. Adams. Mahan and Janice Seiler are the featured speakers at the Valentine banquet tonight. We are honored this morning to have Janice Seiler as our chapel speaker. Janice is a pastoral counselor at the North Carolina Baptist Hospital in Winston-Salem. Both individually and jointly, the Seilers lead numerous workshops in marriage and in family enrichment, lead therapy groups, do counseling with individuals, couples, and groups. We welcome Janice as she comes to speak at this time.
Thank you, Judith. This is indeed an opportunity for me. I was in the last graduating class of Wake Forest, and in a sense I'm coming home, but it's quite different now. I had the opportunity last night to have a rather informal session with a number of women, and some of the wives might have gone home and said to the husbands, "I want you to go hear what that woman has to say." So in a sense, I have a mixed blessing of opportunity. You may be here under duress, but that's okay also. I feel that my experience as a religious educational director, the first 2 years out of college, gives me some background from which to speak to the women here who are also choosing to go into a public ministry. My time as a minister's wife, 15 years, gives me some backdrop for speaking to the wives and to your wives, if they are not here this morning. And then I think my experience in the last 5 years as a pastoral counselor also gives me some backdrop to give you some information that I might have experienced that might have an important bearing on some decisions you might make. The other area that I feel is a real opportunity for me is to share with you some of my own spiritual pilgrimage. During the last 10 years, I have had what I feel to be a spurt in my spiritual growth. And part of that has been because I feel I have done a great deal of growing personally. When you work with people as I do as a counselor, you have to grow or you get out of the business very quickly. Each time I go into a session, I try to go in with the idea that I have something to learn from that person as well as possibly be a healing agent with that person or family. So all of that to say, I had I feel I have a tremendous opportunity this morning, and so as I tried to pick and choose what I might want to share with you, it was a real wrestle. I thought some of you might be expecting me to shed some light on women's liberation, or you might be wanting me to just talk to the clergy wives, and you might want to hear about counseling. I decided that I wanted to share on a more personal level with you rather than get into any specific topic. I do know a little bit about homiletics, so I do have 3 points. What I want you to keep in mind as I talk with you is that I think what I want to share out of my own personal history is definitely applicable to ministry, whether you're going to be a pastor, whether you're going to be a religious educational director, student worker, or whatever. I want you to keep in mind that I want you to apply my learnings to your ministry. That's one point. The second point is I do want to talk about clergy families or ministry among clergy wives and ministers. And the third area that I want to be a hanging point for you is your own personal growth. I feel that in my own growing up, I had some messages given to me that I bought into that I have had to change in the last few years. Gibbon once wrote, "Many a doctrine is like a window pane. We see truth through it, but it divides us from truth." Now, the simple ideas that I want to share with you, you may not call doctrine, but they are, in a sense, that we come to live by them. The first doctrine or message that I received that I feel I have been changing and will still be changing is the message, don't ask. Now somewhere, I don't know that my parents or anyone else said that to me, but I got the message that if I was direct and asked for what I needed or wanted, that was inappropriate, not proper, it was not the thing to do. I would say that I entered my marriage with the potential of ruining it with that message, because somewhere I thought that if Mahan really loved me, that he would know what I wanted, when I wanted it, and how I wanted it. And in fact, if I had to ask for it, that it was not as good when I got it because I had to ask for it. And I have completely changed that, because I do not believe that anymore. However, I do not change that very naturally. I have to work at that. Because each time I am direct and take responsibility for asking for what I need or want, I have to go through a thought process and say, it's okay, Janice, to do that. Now, I don't think that anyone in my background intentionally taught me that. In fact, I don't ever remember hearing that verbalized. But I do think that most of us probably bought in to that message. And I believe that it gets in the way of our ministering. I certainly find it being detrimental in family life. And I know when I take responsibility for my own personal growth, if I am not willing to ask for what I need and want, I do not thrive personally. Now, I think ministers and people in ministering kinds of roles have another subtle impetus to buy into this, because most of us in this kind of position get put apart or up. And people do expect us to know without asking. It's like they think, if I'm coming to you for help, then you're supposed to already know what I need. And in fact, you're almost supposed to do it for me. So actually, we get encouragement because of our position to again buy into this, I'm sure theologically it wouldn't be called a doctrine, but to be proper, I'll call it a doctrine this morning. But most of our responses quite often are given in this subtle arena that we are supposed to know. After all, we have higher education, and we're just supposed to know. And that is an assumption that is most detrimental, I think, in the three areas I have mentioned. I would like to, again, share a rather personal kind of experience with you that shows that just last week I was working on this. My husband loves our dog as much as I do. And so when he comes home in the afternoon, one of the first things he does is set his briefcase down, and she's a little collie, and she has this long nose. And so he walks in, and he usually just cups her face in his hands and just says, "Oh, lady, I'm glad to see you." Well, I was standing at the kitchen window observing that, and I thought that looked awfully nice. So I thought, now, it looks like he would know that I would like that too, but he's never done that to me. So I thought, well, I'll just ask for it. So sure enough, he came in the back door, and I took the risk, and I told him what I had observed. And he said, "Well, I'll tell you what, if you'll wag your tail like she does, I'll do that for you." So I won't be able to do that like Lady does, but that leads me that leads me to my next example. I do believe that most of us do not know how to receive either. We got the message from somewhere that if we take in all of the good things that come our way, we'll become selfish and it'll spoil us. And most of us who are givers, and we are in the giving profession, really do not know how to receive. And I think it's an area that in our ministry and in our family life and in our own personal growth, we could all do some growing up. The idea that I just shared, that's a very personal one, if Mahan had done that to me without my asking, I probably would not have let him know how much I liked it. I would have been a little coy and a little reserved and not really told him, "Whee, that's really neat." Because somewhere in my mind, I think if I really let him know how good it is, he may not do it again. And so if I'm very coy, he'll read my mind and know that I like that. It's a trap. And so I think all of us, probably at a time like that, feel rather out of control. And we givers like being in control. But when we just let go and let someone know how neat it is that we have received this, we feel out of control, and we are out of control. But I would like to encourage you to be out of control sometime and learn how in these areas of your life to really receive. I think Jesus gives us a tremendous example in both of these areas. He was facing the cross and was together with his disciples and other people when this woman, this reckless woman, came in and broke the perfume over his feet, and he heard from the people around him, "Do not allow that. That is not good. Stop her." Jesus knew more than anyone else that he was facing the cross in about 3 days. He knew what was going on in his life, and he knew he needed that. So he asked for it, and right there in front of everybody, he received it and let them know that it meant something to him. And I don't see us doing that as freely as Jesus did. So I would like to encourage you in your ministry and in your home life and in your own personal growth, Learn how to ask for what you need and want, and then when you get it, really take it in. Lady just sort of stands there and just takes all of that attention in and just lets us know how much it means to her. One suggestion on learning how to do this is I think you need to be very specific about what you're asking or what you're asking someone for. Let's take 12:30 on Sunday morning, and you have just been standing at the door, and you did preach a pretty good sermon. You thought so too. And most everyone who comes out says, "Preacher, good sermon, really like that." And the next one says, "Right on, sermon, right on. Tell it like it is." Well, all of these people have gone by, and it's 12:30, and you're just feeling tired. And you almost cannot remember what was said. You heard all of these things, but you didn't take it in. Learn to be specific. Suppose near the end of the line, there's a person that you've gotten to know pretty well, and you can reach out to them. Say, "Hey, Betty Sue, now what about that sermon did you like?" Or, "Jack, can you tell me what was especially helpful to you?" Now that's what you'll remember when you go home and get with your family. You'll remember what Jack or Betty Sue said because you asked for it. And they'll probably tell you if you ask for it, but if you do not, they probably will not tell you. Now all of that is risky, but it's good stuff, believe me. But you have to take responsibility for that. This is particularly true in your family life. How many times have you taken that risk with your children or with your husband or with your wife to let them know that you need to hear something specifically, or you need this right shoulder rubbed right there? Right there would feel good. He or she is not going to know that that's right where it hurts. You have to tell them. There's no way we can read each other's minds. Suppose your wife is a working wife, and you realize that she's worked all day, she feels extra responsibility for the children, she's thinking about going to the church field with you on the weekend, and you think, "I'm going to go home this afternoon and wash those dishes and have that kitchen cleaned up when she comes in." Well, wouldn't it really feel good when she comes in for her just to, "Whoopee, the kitchen's cleaned up." But most of us do not know that that's the kind of response you'd like when you've washed those dishes. So if she doesn't, tell her. Say, "Now, Betty, I washed the dishes and I really want you to do a jig for it." That may sound very unusual and she may wonder what's happened to you. But that whole exchange between the two of you will be life-giving, because that was a neat thing you did. And I'd like to encourage all of you who are working extremely hard, be very sensitive to one another. If your wife says to you on the weekend, "It has been a tremendously hard week. I need some time alone this weekend," be understanding. She knows better than you what her body can take. That you may have to explain to some church members or something like that. But she is responsible for her own well-being now. She is her own best parent. And you must learn how to ask and receive in that family setting in order to really be the kind of ministers that you want to be. And it does take some give and take. But you must learn to ask and receive. And be expressive when you do receive from one another in all areas. It's something that I have had to learn, and I find that most of us in the giving professions really need to learn how to do both of those new ideas. And you may have heard them before, but actually they're new ideas. I think we'll have to undo some learning. There is a story about the next idea that I want to read to you that I think says what I want to say better than I could. And the idea that I have had to work on is to give affirmation and love straight on. Somewhere I learned that it was really better to tell Betty to tell Sue what I thought rather than me telling Sue straight. And it feels so much better when we get it straight from the person who's saying it. I don't know, some people have said this is a Southern kind of message that might be peculiar to our area. I don't know. I know it gets in the way. This is called Love in the Cabbie. I was in New York the other day and rode with a friend in a taxi. When we got out, my friend said to the driver, "Thank you for the ride. You did a superb job." The taxi driver was stunned for a second. Then he said, "Are you a wise guy or something?" "No, my dear man, and I'm not putting you on. I admire the way you keep cool in heavy traffic." "Yeah," the driver said and drove off. "What was that all about?" I asked. "I'm trying to bring love back to New York," he said. "I believe it's the only thing that can save the city." "How can one man save New York?" "It's not one man. I believe I have made the taxi driver's day. Suppose he has 20 fares. He's going to be nice to those 20 fares because someone was nice to him. Those fares, in turn, will be kinder to their employees or shopkeepers or waiters or even their own families. Eventually, the goodwill could spread to at least 1,000 people." Now, that isn't bad, is it? "But you're depending on the taxi driver to pass your goodwill to others." "I'm not depending on it," my friend said. "I'm aware that the system isn't foolproof, so I might deal with 10 different people today. If out of 10, I can make 3 happy, then eventually I can indirectly influence the attitudes of 3,000 more. Sounds good on paper," I admitted, "but I'm not sure it works in practice. Nothing is lost if it doesn't. I didn't take any of my time to tell that man he was doing a good job. He neither received a larger tip nor a smaller tip. And if it fell on deaf ears, so what? Tomorrow there will be another taxi driver whom I can try to make happy." "You're some kind of a nut," I said. "That shows you how cynical you've become. I've made a study of this, and the thing that seems to be lacking, besides money, of course, for our postal employees, is that no one tells them the kind of work they're doing is good." "But it's not a good job," I said. "They're not doing a good job because they feel no one cares if they do. Why shouldn't someone say a kind word to them?" We were walking past a structure in the process of being built and past 5 workmen eating their lunch. My friend stopped. "That's a magnificent job you men have done. It must be difficult and dangerous work." The 5 men eyed my friend suspiciously. "When will it be finished?" he said. "June," a man grunted. "Ah, that's really impressive. You must all be very proud." We walked away and I said to him, "I haven't seen anyone like you since the man from La Mancha." When those men digest my words, they will feel better for it. Somehow the city will benefit from their happiness. "But you can't do this all alone," I protested. "You're just one man. The most important thing is not to get discouraged. Making people in the city become kind again is not an easy job. But if I can enlist other people in my campaign..." "Hey, you just winked at a very plain-looking woman," I said. "Yes, I know," he replied. "And if she's a school teacher, her class will be in for a fantastic day." I think so much of what we feel for each other really does go unsaid. And I would like to encourage you to share particularly your kind, caring thoughts with one another. When you get back with your family tonight, whatever comes to your mind, say it, especially the caring, appreciative things that you feel. In my counseling, quite often the most neglected part of a relationship is that they have not said what they really thought. And quite often my counseling sessions are structured so that they hear what they've wanted to hear, but have not taken the time or structured in what I call maintenance time to share it. One of the neatest things we do in our marriage enrichment weekends is that we structure an appreciation time, and we ask the couples to bombard each other with some appreciations. Now, you may think, oh, well, I know he thinks that. Well, I know she thinks that. But it feels so good to hear it. And the way we structure that is we say to one, tell your spouse, we like to say spouse instead of spouse, I appreciate, and then the words, and she or he doesn't say a thing. They just sit there and listen. And then you say, and I appreciate, and say what you think. They don't say a word. They just take it in. And can you imagine what it's like to get about 10 or 12 of those at one time? It's beautiful. But what most of us do not structure into our lives is that kind of time. And that's one of the values of involving yourself in a structured time where some of those things happen. The one other area that I want to mention to you that I have had to work on in my own personal growth is nurturing myself. Somewhere I got the idea also that that would spoil me, or that Mahan was supposed to do that for me. And it is not right for me to expect my self-esteem and caring to be dependent on him. I am responsible for my relationship with God. I truly believe that when I meet my Maker, he will not be asking me about what Mahan thought or what Mahan did or what Mahan accomplished or even what we did together. But I'm going to be responding to my Maker. And I am a woman who is responsible for those kinds of decisions. I need to take responsibility for parenting and caring for myself now. My parents are somewhere else. And it really is okay for us to do that. And no one else knows better how to do that than ourselves. But we have to take responsibility for that. On my last birthday, our twins gave me one of these hurricane lamps. And we had visitors in the home at that time. And Julia said to me, hey, Mom, you can take the lamp and put in the bathroom in the place of your candle. That's all she said. And the next morning, we got up for breakfast, and Ethel came up to me. She said, I couldn't sleep last night for wondering what Julia meant about that candle in the bathroom. So I told her. I said, usually in the late afternoon, either before supper or right after supper, sometime in the late afternoon, I close the bathroom door, and I run a tub of hot water and light a candle. And everybody in the family knows that that is my time. Now, they may have to wait a little while on supper or whatever, but they know that that's mother's time. That's what I call my drooping hour, and I have to take care of myself if I'm going to function through the evening. And Ethel's comment to me was, I used to have to get a migraine in order to get that kind of time. None of us want to get into that kind of not caring for ourselves until we forget how to do it. So as you think of your ministry, as you think of your family life and of your own personal growth, will you learn how to ask? Will you learn how to really receive? Will you learn how to give your thoughts and caring words straight and when you think of them? And will you take responsibility for nurturing and caring for yourself, because you know better than someone else what is really needed? Thank you. I'd like for us to spend just a moment in some quietness. And if you will you think of one of these areas that you might try on today with someone, maybe your mate, maybe one of your colleagues, but will you risk some new behavior today, and will you spend just a few moments deciding what that will be? Father, we are in a great place to give and receive caring. But sometimes we see this place as a fresh water pond, but we're like fish in it, dying of thirst, because we do not ask and we do not take in what is there for us. Help us to love one another and ourselves as you loved us and sent your Son to die on the cross for us. You do love us so much, and we do receive that love this morning. In the name of Christ I pray. Amen. Thank you. You're dismissed.